From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's interesting, entertaining, and accessible. Right. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
Hey, good morning, Lynn. I'm Chris Cherniak, sitting in for John Wells today. Well, today in the program, we rebroadcast an interview with award-winning journalist Dave Levitan. His new book is called Not a Scientist: How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. It's a handbook on fake news about science and is timely for reasons we need not even state. It begins with President Reagan and his first utterance of the now often used phrase, quote, "I'm not a scientist, but," unquote.
That's right. Yeah. Good morning, Chris. Thanks for joining me. And then in the second half, we'll explore some topics that we didn't get a chance to last week, like are solar panels toxic, for example?
No.
And then we'll be joined by some engineering students from the PC CAPS program at Park City High School. Josh Lansky and Sky Martin will join us. And they're going to just tell us what they've been doing now that, wow, the school year's already almost over.
Right, and their project should be wrapping up.
Should be wrapping up, although I believe one is just getting going, and we'll talk to them about that. One's at the PC Mark.
Okay.
So the PC CAPS program, engineering students in the second half of the hour. This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Hi, this is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. The Epic School Kids program gives all children across the state of Utah from kindergarten through fifth grade 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek, here with my guest co-host, Chris Cherniak. Well, there are a bunch of ways, our guest Dave Levitan says, that enemies of science distort the facts to make them suitable, more suitable for whatever agenda.
Ideas.
Yes. to fit their ideas and their agenda.
Their agendas and their policies.
Yes, in some ways, in many ways, many instances, politicians presume to not be a scientist, yet by that mere disclaimer, they can then claim whatever.
With saying whatever they want to say.
This all began back with President Reagan and his first utterance of the phrase that's now used all the time. I'm not a scientist, but.
Right. And I actually remember hearing that 1981, 82, or I was in college. And he was talking about acid rain. And he said, I'm not a scientist, but I believe more sulfur gets emitted by one volcano than all of the sulfur that is emitted by man-made smokestacks, et cetera. And so,
it had absolutely no basis in fact.
Right.
Of any kind.
Right. But the point was that he was able to say, he set up this opinion, right? It was an opinion that by qualifying as, well, I'm not a scientist, but this is what I believe.
That's
and
right.
And so now we move forward and everybody takes on that affect. I'm not a scientist, but this is what I believe. The other one, popular one, is always grinds my gears, is just saying. You know, you can say whatever you want and then step back and say, well, I'm just saying, you know, because this is what I hear. Okay.
That's right.
You can't do that in science.
We interviewed Dave Levitan a couple of weeks ago, and it was a really interesting interview. We thought we'd rebroadcast. And, you know, this book is being called, you know, the handbook for fake news. How to decipher. We all need this, and fake news when it comes to science in particular. And people are saying, you know, every member of Congress needs to read this book. You know, and just
that'd
watch.
Be nice.
We do have, as people who speak in public, we have an obligation. Politicians have an obligation to state facts.
To state facts, at least understand the facts, and if more importantly, if they don't understand the facts, say so, or stay out of the conversation until they do have a fuller understanding of the facts. How about that?
How about that? All right. The book is Not a Scientist.
Not Scientist. How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science.
Dave Levitin, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you. Your book was fun, but it was sad in a way because it really speaks directly to the current state of affairs in our country, which is nobody seems to tell the truth anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Although I guess I would say that it's not nobody. If we want to look on the bright side, there are still some who are willing to tell the truth or at least try and address it as well as they can. But I agree, it does feel like something of a sort of depressing state of affairs at the moment in that regard.
Yeah. And so your book is a fun read. It's a quick read. And you have a number of gimmicks, tools that politicians will use, the oversimplification, the cherry pick, the butter up and undercut, the demonizer. Let's talk about a couple of these. How about the oversimplifications?
Sure. So that's probably sort of the most basic of the errors or tricks that I talk about. It's pretty much what it sounds like. A lot of times politicians will take what is, you know, can be a very complicated topic and boil it down to basically a soundbite, some pithy little quote that just kind of ignores all the subtlety and nuance that goes into all sorts of scientific issues. Of course, it can be useful to boil down complicated topics to help people understand them. But if you do that and just sort of abandon any semblance of you know, validity or support for the way you're doing it, you're really doing everybody a disservice. So people do this on all sorts of things, like saying marijuana is a gateway drug. Well, that's a complicated topic. There's a lot of research into that. And just saying it without actually going into those details, you're really just kind of confusing people rather than helping people understand it.
So, Dave, in the beginning of your book, you start off by talking about President Ronald Reagan back in the 80s and talking about sulfur dioxide and Mount St. Helens. Tell us that story. And is this, you know, according to what you're talking about here, is that's when it started, this I'm not a scientist, but...
Yeah, that was the first example I could find. I should say, I can't promise that no one's used it before that, but that was certainly the first one that I found. It was actually still during the presidential campaign in 1980. Ronald Reagan was asked about sulfur dioxide emissions, which is the primary component of acid rain. And he talked about how he thought that Mount St. Helens, which had erupted recently, how it had contributed far more sulfur dioxide to the atmosphere than humans did. And he prefaced it by saying, I'm not a scientist, but I think that Mount St. Helens is worse at this than we are. And it turns out he was completely wrong about that. There were Mount St. Helens did release sulfur dioxide, but in fact humans, mostly through burning of fossil fuels and at factories and industrial sites, we released far more than a single volcano did. So he was pretty far off on that, but he did sort of, I guess, give birth to this talking point that then has persisted through the decade.
I believe you came up with the data point, which is Mount St. Helens gave off about 2,000 tons of sulfur dioxide daily, whereas humans in this country with all their cars give up about 81,000 tons of sulfur dioxide daily.
Yeah, that's right. And when you start to look at, you know, sources around the world, it gets even more sort of skewed in favor of humans. We have, you know, we managed to dominate natural sources in a lot of ways like that. And in fact, there was an era that was very similar. I discussed later in the book, decades later, Mike Huckabee talked about volcanoes again, and he still got it very wrong, although this time he was talking about carbon dioxide rather than sulfur dioxide. But he was wrong by even more, many, many orders of magnitude wrong. Humans are by far the dominant source of carbon dioxide.
If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with Dave Levitin. He's written Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. Dave, in the early 90s, in the late 80s, I was running a federal division And actually, I was running a whole country, but I had the federal group under my responsibility. And calling on NASA, they had had this big change where they said, you know, we're doing all this exploring outside of our Earth, but we're going to now focus, we think we should focus on our own planet and trying to understand it. And they put a number of satellites up, and they created a tremendous amount of data, and they would analyze it on weather patterns, on all sorts of different things. And so what really caught my attention in your book was the butter up and undercut when Ted Cruz praises NASA and then slams them on the budget side. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So that technique, basically, as you said, it involves praising a certain topic, usually a topic that has a lot of public support. So people like NASA. NASA is very popular. Or other things like, you know, cancer research, things that are very hard to criticize because the public generally agrees with them. However, you praise them, and at the same time, you sort of subtly try and cut their legs off, cut funding for a certain part, or just generally try and undermine the support for that thing. So in the case of Ted Cruz and NASA, he sort of went out of his way to praise NASA, to praise astronauts and all the scientists doing all this great work when it comes to exploring the solar system or the sun and all these sort of outside of Earth kinds of projects. But at the same time, he said we needed to start focusing outward rather than inward. And he would use phrases about how NASA has lost its core mission because they're focusing too much on Earth science. Now, that was sort of ridiculous in a lot of ways, but his point was basically to try and defund climate change research because NASA is one of the primary sources of climate data and research that we have through a lot of those satellites and everything that you mentioned. But he really sort of misrepresented the science there because NASA has been doing that sort of thing for, as you said, decades. And in fact, you can go all the way back to the founding documents of NASA that in 1958 and again in the years since then, you can find documents that talk about studying our own atmosphere. That has been a core mission of NASA from the very beginning. So his claim that, you know, NASA is great because we go explore Pluto, but not because we explore Earth, is really kind of a bit of misdirection. And it really serves to sort of undermine the support for that institution.
And that core mission in the late 80s and the early 90s was actually signed off by Congress and supported by Congress. So I don't understand how he can come in and think that he can completely manipulate and change the mission just because he doesn't want to talk about climate change. But a lot of that goes on today, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think it's, you know, it's relatively easy for a politician to get away with in a sense, because, I mean, if you ask, you know, a person who might not know the history of it, you know, what does NASA do? They might say, well, we go to the moon or, you know, we study Jupiter. I mean, these are sort of very like commonly understood things. And of course, NASA does do those things. But it's a little bit easier to say if you're someone who's trying to cut climate change funding, you know, to try and pretend that we haven't been looking at our own atmosphere and you know, related issues, studying ice and the Arctic and everything. These things are things NASA has been doing for so long. But it's sort of easy to jump in there, you know, and sort of change the path a little bit.
Dave, we spoke last month or so with a writer for Wired magazine, who had gone to Macedonia on and done an expose on fake news and talked about, you know, who believes fake news most readily and who doesn't buy it at all, presumably for their smarts and their ability to decipher, shall we call it BS, when they hear it. And I suppose that you've written this book, Not a Scientist, for some of the same reasons, to give us a little training on how to not be so darn gullible when it comes to what our politicians say. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess that's the hope. I mean, obviously, when it comes to science in particular, these can be very complicated topics. I mean, we can't possibly expect all of us to, you know, have training in all the things that government deals with in terms of science. There's just too much, and it can be very complicated. So my hope was just to give a few tools to sort of, you know, see through some of the ways that this gets misused by politicians. So there are some sort of tips in there that maybe can help, I don't know, maybe gain a little bit of skepticism when we're listening to politicians talk about science. So, you know, that could be Sorry, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering what it is neurolinguistically that makes us believe that we're about to hear some well-founded science when someone says, I'm not a scientist, but, I mean, why do we then expect science?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I guess I might say that I'm not so sure we all do. There was, okay. As I mentioned in the introduction of the book, there was even a Republican sort of strategist and consultant who called that line, the I'm not a scientist line, he called it the dumbest talking point of all time. So even people who sort of use it maybe have come around to the idea that it doesn't really help anybody. So, but I agree that, you know, it sort of sets us up in a way to maybe take what we're about to hear with a grain of salt. It almost makes it so that we don't expect that much of what's coming, if that makes sense. And then maybe some of these errors or you know, sort of tricks and devices can slip past us a little easier.
Yeah. I just want to say this morning I was driving to work thinking about when I say things like that, I'm not a scientist, but granted, I'm not a politician trying to sell my point one way or another. But I do often say, now don't quote me on this, but, you know, I read this article and this is, kind of, you know, it's my way of wanting to share something without possibly having all the hard, you know, facts. Is human nature, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, I've certainly done the same thing. I will, you know, tell people I'm not entirely sure about this or this could have been, you know, I'm not sure if this was double checked by someone. I don't think that instinct that you have or that probably a lot of us have is necessarily a bad thing or is necessarily quite the same as the way politicians are using it. I think they're using it more sort of as a smokescreen in a way, as a way to give themselves cover when they do go out and actually, you know, develop policy based on what can be some pretty unsound science. When you do it, I think you're just trying to help people understand that there might be some that you might be wrong, that it might be something that you're not entirely sure about. So I'm not sure it's quite the same, and I think that it's admirable to want to tell people that there is uncertainty in what you're going to tell them about.
I think that people wouldn't dodge or fabricate or falsify the truth or play on emotions unless they could get away with it. And if they're speaking to their base of supporters, I mean, we have a divided country. If they're speaking to their base wants to hear this because it complements and supports their belief system. And, you know, the thing I was thinking about as I read your book was that, you know, when we fell out of the tree and started walking upright many, many years ago, since that time, there have been snake oil salesmen and people that would sell you swampland in Florida or the Brooklyn Bridge. But it just seems to me that although this fabrication has been going on forever, that there's a change that's taken place in just the last 40 years or so, and for lack of better word, that lying is more commonplace, almost accept it. And I don't know what it's all about, but it just seems, you know, I mean, people don't wake up or they're not born as liars. They first tell a little white lie, then this happens, that happens, and it happens gradually. Maybe a society progresses the same way. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I don't have a, you know, a sort of clear answer to that either. It does feel, as you say, like there seems to be more tendency to lie about things these days. There is a chance, though, that's more sort of like perception bias in a way, that because we are able to look things up a little more quickly, that we are able to find an answer a lot easier than when Ronald Reagan said, I'm not a scientist in 1980, that it might just feel like it's happening more. But in fact, it maybe didn't, and it's just that we are able to find them quicker. I mean, in a way, that's sort of an optimistic answer, because it means that we're doing a better job, you know, kind of cutting through some of those. I'm not entirely sure that's true, but it does feel like maybe there's a little bit of just sort of a change in the way we process information, and that is making it seem like it's happening more. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and to that point, and I think it's a good one, you can get data to support any viewpoint. So if, you know, if some people believe that 99.9% of scientists believe that man is contributing to climate change, you can go out there and you can find someone that says that that's not true. You know, it's only 50% of the scientists or 55%. And people will take those data points, knowing that they're false, and they'll just restate them or repackage them. So there's, you know, the internet is an opportunity to support your lies and to, you know, sort of hoodwink the public.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I have a chapter in there called "The Blame the Blogger," which is exactly as you say. There's for every good information out there, there's some source of bad information too. And oftentimes, if there is something online that supports a particular politician's position or ideology, they'll use it just knowing that, like, they can blame that source rather than taking the blame themselves, even if the source is not remotely reputable. So as you said, one of the examples was about the consensus surrounding climate change, where some people on a blog basically wrote a post saying that 97% was actually closer to 43%. I forget the exact number, but they took, you know, just remarkable liberties with some math in a survey. I mean, it didn't really make a ton of sense, but it could be hard to understand that if you don't have time to go look up every survey that's ever been done on this. When a politician says that in a speech or on television, that one was actually on Bill Maher's show, it can be hard to see through.
It's really disheartening to me that there is even a conversation that is partisan surrounding science, but it's very real and very current. And as we mentioned in our introduction, the March for Science going on in various towns around the country this Saturday. One's taking place on Main Street right here in Park City, where various scientists will be speaking. You implicate, John Boehner, Rick Perry, Marco Rubio, even Trump to some degree, although you say in your prologue that your book was mostly written by the time he was elected. So maybe there's a whole other book, as you say, that could be written about that. But do liberals are they implicated in some way? Where's the guilt there?
Yes, absolutely. I did not intend the book to be sort of a partisan statement. I readily acknowledge that most of the examples in there are from one side of the aisle. I think that that's really just a reflection of reality. I don't think it's a particularly partisan statement to say that the Republican Party has definitely been on the wrong side of scientific issues for quite some time now, just from a scientific perspective. But that's not to say that it's only Republicans. There are Democrats that do appear in the book. President Obama is in there a couple times with some admittedly sort of minor errors that he has made on science. And there are some issues that tend to cross party lines a little bit differently. Genetically modified organisms are actually sort of the main one I can think of on that, where there doesn't seem to be as strict a partisan divide on who is misunderstanding or misinterpreting the available scientific knowledge. So while, yes, it is certainly mostly one party these days, it's not all that party, and I certainly don't think that, you know, one side of the aisle will have a monopoly on scientific expertise forever. There's no reason it couldn't flip at some point.
And I just say that really so that if we have some partisan folk out there, some conservatives that are listening and maybe turned off by this book, it's a really great, I think that's why I said it. Don't be turned off. Let's go into it. Let's gather the facts and let's learn, all of us, what to watch out for and those little trigger statements that, you know, after which we ought to, you know, our shackles ought to be up a bit.
Yeah, I hope that's the result. I hope that people can go into it sort of understanding that I'm really trying to help, you know, gain an appreciation for evidence, that no matter what politician is talking about science, that they need to be able to support a claim and they need to be able to provide evidence no matter what.
Dave, I have to ask you about your dedication. To my wife, Jamie, and to Schrodinger's cat, the cat will know why, but only if you ask it. You got to talk about that.
Well, that's a good question. Basically, I mean, I don't know how much everybody knows about Schrodinger's cat, but the idea was this was a thought experiment where a cat is in a box, and if you leave the box closed, there is a chance every second that the cat will be either alive or dead.
Right.
So, and until you open the box and observe it, technically, according to quantum mechanics, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time.
Exactly.
So that concept sort of came up on my very first date with my wife. and my point about you have to ask it is that issue of observation, right? The cat does not have to decide if it's alive or dead until you open it and look at it.
Right.
So the cat knows the answer to this, but it won't know until you actually ask it. That was my point there.
And I always thought that it was just a bizarre thought experiment, when in fact Schrodinger and Einstein, who used to hang out and talk about these sorts of things, they or Schrodinger presented it and Einstein agreed to discuss the absurdness of quantum mechanics, quantum theory. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree. That thought experiment was designed to sort of make people think this whole thing was ridiculous, but it turns out, I mean, it doesn't work for a cat, but it does work for fundamental particles. That idea of superposition of states and observation being required before they decide on which state they're in, it's all actually bizarrely true.
Right. Well, Dave Levitin has written Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. It's a fun read again. We want to thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. That was fun.
Okay, it's fun for us too. Thank you.
Again, that was Dave Levitin. We conducted that interview a couple of weeks ago when John Wells was in the studio.
Right,
now
that's
he's
why
he's
I
on
wasn't
assignment,
there.
And that's why it, okay. That's why you're here now.
Got it.
So interesting.
Science.
Yeah. Absolutely. And more of it when we return. It's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we are proud to support KPCW. With our new 352 Main Street entrance, the Spur now features three bars serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Hey, Chris, you brought a visual aid to a radio program today.
I did. I forgot this was radio.
Sure you did. Well, let me tell our listeners what you brought. You can hear it
What's
a little
it sound
bit.
Sound like?
Sounds like a wrapper. It is.
Yeah, you can see it.
Yeah, it's a plastic bag.
It's a
and
plastic bag.
Inside the plastic bag is what, Chris? This is kind of the story and our segue into what we're talking about next.
Right. We're going to spend a few minutes talking about the proposed plastic bag ban ordinance that is up for discussion tonight at City Council. What I did, I've been helping out the Park City Plastics Coalition in championing this effort, championing this ordinance. A couple nights ago, I live at Racquet Club Village. My unit is literally behind the mark. All right, so I'm behind the building, behind the tennis courts,
it's
behind
a pretty
that
nice
park.
Place. Clean, well maintained.
So I stepped out my door, and first I found the plastic bag underneath my deck. All right, my bad, a plastic shopping bag. And I took that and I walked around and I collected other plastic bags that I found under the trees, in the trees in some cases, around the shrubs, and plastic film. All right, and that's what I have here. And in 20 minutes, I filled my little plastic shopping bag with other plastic bags, newspaper bags, these guys. And like I say, plastic film, not paper, not the bottles I saw, not metal, not set, just plastic film. And I have, in 20 minutes, filled my bag. And otherwise, like we say, is a pretty clean place.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the side of the road. So the point is that we have a ban that's being proposed on plastic bags. This is not a plastic bag ban per se, too.
It is.
We'll get into that.
It's very narrow.
It's very narrow.
The city
scope.
Is trying to start off in a kind of a small way, and you can
also
stop
brought
crinkling
in some dirt
the plastic bag.
With my bag. But right, this is a what we consider a fairly narrow or addressing a very narrow component of our plastic bag and film that we have in our daily lives.
So within city limits, we have two major grocery stores and one drugstore that is, this is kind of what it's focused
this
on.
This is focused on the plastic grocery bags, 2.25 mil gauged plastic polyethylene bags that come from the Market, Fresh Market, and Rite Aid. Okay, that's it. All the other stores don't have to comply with this yet. This is just this ordinance, okay? This is small steps, and it's good. This is good because this is something big for the state of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about why this is a big deal and the potential ramifications of that.
Let's talk about this because it's been brought before the city over the years that at least I've been at the radio station. Citizens coming to ask the city council to create a plastic bag ban. And each time they've said, it's not really possible for us living in the state that we do because the legislature would kick back with some sort of legislation saying, you can't do this.
You can't. And in fact, some states have done just that.
But there's been a workaround of sorts.
Well, some sorts, and I don't. You know, I don't know the details of the politics behind this, but some states, most recently Michigan, the legislature there put a law that bans communities or denies communities from establishing bans on plastic bags, and they made it retroactive. So the city of Ann Arbor, which had recently set up a plastic bag ban ordinance, now loses that ordinance because the state of Michigan said you can't do that. And not only can't you do that, no one can ever do that. So the state of Utah legislature will pay attention to this. And this is one of the consequences or one of the pushbacks that we could see. This is why the city, Park City, is doing the smart thing and starting small and working with just a few stores with one type of bag, 2.25 mils, which by the way, Lynn, what is a mil? There's
it's
a difference between a mil and a millimeter.
That's right. A mil is a thousandth of
an inch.
Thank you. Different than a millimeter.
Which is a thousandth of a meter. Big difference.
Big difference,
that's
right.
That's why these are really, really thin.
They're just
2.25
mils.
Gauge bags. This is the grocery bag that you carry out. Okay.
You know, quickly, we were talking before we went on air, and we have just a minute before we welcome on our next guest from the PC CAPS engineering program. But you were talking about what this is and what this isn't. And you feel that this is about our environment.
In conclusion, this is about our environment and protecting our environment. This is not going to reduce our carbon footprint per se. Right? It helps a little bit because mm-hmm. plastic bags come from natural gas, condensates, and barrels of oil, et cetera. But this is a small, you know, this is like a French fry and a Happy Meal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all this is with respect to our carbon footprint. What you want to reduce your carbon footprint? Think about what goes into this bag when you go shopping. Right? Who has a larger carbon footprint? The person that brings their reusable bag but fills it with fruits and vegetables.
From Chile
and New Zealand and thousands mm-hmm. of miles away, or fish that was just swimming 48 hours ago off the coast of Hawaii, or someone who buys local fruits and vegetables but puts it in a plastic bag. Who has a larger carbon footprint?
Obviously, the one with the plastic
bag. Right, that's where your carbon footprint matters and who fills it with meat.
So incremental steps. You know, we have to recognize, as Dan Levitin was talking about, what it means and what it doesn't mean.
Yeah.
And there's a price for everything.
There's no free lunch.
But
that's a good point.
I will say, just from a consumer standpoint, I love cloth bags.
Yeah.
And when I forget them, I get bummed out at myself. In fact, I don't even use plastic anymore because you can just load them into your cart, load all your groceries into the cart, take them to your car, load them. And then when you get your cloth bag from the house, come out to your car and load everything in. That's what I do now because I realize having used a lot of cloth bags, they fit like four times the amount of weight and volume.
Right.
And, you know, they don't rip.
Right.
They never rip. So I like
basically
it from a consumer standpoint.
They have a long shelf life, a long half-life, too.
Yeah.
So this ordinance, to me, is about protecting the environment. These bags do what? They do physical, chemical, biological harm to our environment. The physical harm, they clog our drains. They clog up our streams. They're float. You know what? The biggest piece of plastic that I saw when I was walking around was in the tree. I couldn't get to it because it floated up in the tree. So they harm our environment. They chemically break down. They photodegrade. And then those chemicals get into the soil and our surface water and our groundwater. And then they do biological harm to our animals, birds, and other animals who mistake this for food and nibble on it, particularly if there's food residue on these bags and stuff. So it's really about reducing our litter and protecting our environment.
Whole Foods hasn't used plastic bags for a while. They use paper bags if you're looking for disposable bags. I don't remember when they did that, but there's obviously a big impact as well if you're using a paper bag.
They made a personal decision mm-hmm. to do that. And that's probably a lot based on their clients and their customers mm-hmm. who come in and say that. And that's what if you want to see this expand, it's up to us as consumers and customers to go talk to other stores and say, hey, would you guys consider not having plastic bags? It's a power of the collective here.
Right. All right. So if you're interested in this topic tonight at the Park City Council meeting, in the regular meeting, at 6 o'clock, they have a pretty hefty agenda.
They do.
And it's a few down on the agenda. But if you got there at 6 o'clock, you won't miss it. You may wait a bit. But
would you say you wait as someone who covers council?
Yeah.
You'll probably wait because they have lots to talk. All right.
Lots to talk about.
But that's on the agenda for tonight.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be back with the PC CAPS engineering students from Park City High School. They're talking about what they've been doing over the school year. That's just about to end when we return. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Chris is filling in for John Wells today. Always great to have you with your
Thanks
environmental engineering perspective.
Whether you like it or not sometimes.
That's right. I do like it. Well, we're joined now in the studio by a couple of engineering students from the PC CAPS program, along with their supervisor, I guess we'll call him, or advisor, who's also new this year to the PC CAPS program, Chris Humbert. We've got Sky Martin and Josh Lansky joining us to recap. I know that the year doesn't go quickly for students, but I've been meaning to get Chris on all year,
and
here we are, like school's almost out.
Well, he probably has some time.
Yeah, he's got time now. So welcome to Cool Science Radio. Thanks for coming, all of you.
Thank you.
So, Chris, let's start with you. I believe I heard that you came from the architecture world. Is that right?
I did. I practiced architecture for about 18 years. Actually worked up here in Park City for the Olympics, which was a lot of fun. Was the designer on the Park City Mountain Resort venue. So snowboarding, Alpine GS, but then often in architecture, the economy goes up and down and affects us drastically. And so 2008, in our last economic downturn, I had to make a career shift and got into education, first with a science and tech program as an administrator, and then everybody encouraged me to become a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I never thought I'd be a teacher, and here I am now.
Well, yeah, least of all teaching engineering.
Yeah, well, I teach a lot of the design-related classes. So the engineering, I'm going to be doing CAD, so mm-hmm. computer-assisted design next year, digital photography next year. And the CAPS program is a capstone engineering program, So I focus on the design process. And it's really similar whether you're designing video games, which I teach, or architecture or engineering. So it's been a lot of fun.
All right. So what kind of projects have you been working on this semester or the students been working on?
I can let Sky and Josh talk about the one they're working on. We have three projects currently happening. We're working on a project with a company called Ardusat out of Salt Lake City. So they're designing a tilt table, which is being used to test some of the sensors in this Ardusat technology with one of our great mentors, just incredible engineer named Bob Sloan, who is helping them with the electronics and just understanding everything about how these sensors work. Another group is doing emergency housing this semester. So, you know, we're all aware that we might have an earthquake sometime in the next 50 years. And so that's really the most likely emergency that would displace a lot of people. So two of our students are designing sort of pop-up type housing that could be dropped off in your front yard, and maybe a family in that day could put it together so they have a place to sleep that night and live for maybe up to a year.
And so when you say they're putting that together, I think they're actually drafting up a design on paper, conceptual design, or maybe even beyond that, maybe even a physical three-dimensional product at the end of the semester, right?
Yeah, that particular project, they did hand drawings, and then they did CAD, so 3D modeling using SketchUp.
Okay.
And then with that, they were able to do 3D printing of small models, physical models. They can do videos from that.
Right. And then they give a presentation to the group or to their client.
Yeah, what it really makes the PC Caps program unique is that they work for a real client. So the client gives them the project. They design it for the semester. They have meetings along the way. Sometimes the client changes the whole scope halfway through, which you know, happens.
That happens in the real world.
That happens in the real world. And Josh can talk about
that. You
guys
are nodding your head. You have real life experiences with that? Yeah. Okay, we'll get to that in a second. But at the end of the day, I said it, Lynn. I said it at the end of the day. In conclusion, they're working as like engineering, junior engineers, engineering interns with a client on a project with a scope of work, with milestones and a schedule
and real
of
deadlines.
Deliverables and real deadlines.
And pressure sometimes because
and the pressure that goes with that.
And maybe we should let Josh talk because he's on a project. Josh and Sky are both on a project right now that has all of that. Deadline and scope change and scope creep and
so you know. let's talk about that. I mean, first of all, Sky, why don't you start? When people say, "What is this PC Caps thing that you're doing?" I mean, we just heard Chris explain it, and he has worked with PC Caps over
That's
the first couple years that it was in existence, so he knows. What do you say to people who ask
what PC Caps is?
Mm-hmm.
It's a way for students to use what they learn in school and direct it into a real life scenario, or not even a scenario, because we're working for real clients and they're implementing our projects into their company. Mm-hmm. So it really has changed my life and my sister's life, being able to see, okay, I'm learning calculus, but what's the point? Why do I need to know how to take the integral of this thing? Oh, I can use that in my project. I can use my physics to see if I can make this jump for the sculpture that we're doing right now. So it's a really amazing way to get students interested in life after college.
It's applied science.
It's amazing.
That's what engineering is all. It's applied science. Mm-hmm. So what is your project?
Yeah, so our project is a kinetic sculpture at the Mark. It's going to be made out of all skis and recycled equipment. And it's basically like a marble run. We're using ICOS balls. Our mentor, Mike Wong, designed those with some PC Cap students a couple years ago.
Right.
And those are going to be the marbles for our design. Yeah.
That's great. Josh, let's get you in here. Are you working on this design, too, that'll go into the PC Mark?
I am as well, yes. It's the two of us together on this fun project.
Oh, yeah. And we've seen Mike Wong around for years and know that he comes up with great projects to do, and he's so into it himself. So I didn't realize that it was you two working with him.
So who's your – I'm sorry.
Yeah, when are you going to start the the sculpture,
right?
The
Hopefully,
building.
With the schedule right now, it should be right around May 25th. But right now, we're still, I think, waiting to figure out what our final design is going to be with the sculpture that's going to hold up this our giant marble run. So once we get that figured out, we'll know more of a certain deadline that we have.
Mm-hmm. Amy, you've been working on this thing since February, right?
No, we started. Okay. We started in late March.
Okay.
And early March. It has been a sprint.
Right. So why? What are some of the challenges? We talked about scope creep, mm-hmm. or the client changes their mind. What did you face?
I mean, honestly, right now we're just trying to push through as fast as we can because we started so late because we had a project before this working with the architecture firm VCBO that's going to do the remodel on the high school. So mm-hmm. we worked with them for the first month of this semester, mm-hmm. and then we jumped into this project that was so real that we had maybe 3 months to complete. And so we've just been pushing through and just trying to get as much as we can done.
Yeah, yeah. And the big thing with that is we have to get building plans and everything like that before we start actually building it. So we've been having deadlines. Like last week we had to finish the building plans, and now we're working with other architects to try to see if it's going to stay up in the mark, and if there's an earthquake, if it will not fall down.
Right.
So
failure analysis.
Yes. Yep.
All right. Ah. So who's the client?
The mark and the Park City Council.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So your deadline then is the end of this month.
Possibly,
to have something actually there at the mark. That's the goal?
Yeah, I think we're shooting for the beginning of June.
Okay.
But the deadline really is not so much imposed by the Park City Council, is it, as it is by the fact that are you two graduating, for example, or are you juniors?
No, we both are graduating.
We're both graduating.
This year.
Yeah. Okay. So you want, but you're not going to get to that point in the project where you go, you know what, I'm done with high school. I'm done. I know. I realize it's not built, but.
Well, what happens there, Chris? I mean, can projects go into the next semester?
We do have projects that can continue on.
Right.
You know, we had a project last semester that was a pairing with the University of Utah School of Medicine. It was a UV sensor project and got a fair amount of attention. And it's kind of in a holding pattern this semester, so we're hoping to pick it up again mm-hmm. maybe next semester. That IQOS ball project is another one that has been kind of on again, off again for the whole time we've had PC caps. There was the design of the initial toy, then there was design for the packaging and marketing surrounding that, and now it's coming back again as part of this kinetic sculpture. Mm-hmm. So with this mark project, the deadline really has been imposed by the client.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
The mark it was a request for proposals, and the construction deadline was on that, and it was very, very tight. Mike Wong was able to push it back by a few weeks, and it might adjust again because the city has imposed some structural requirements that could slow it down a little bit. But we've been lucky that it times pretty well with the end of the semester.
Okay.
Josh, what would you say that you've learned the most about regarding how the real world operates? And even feel free to throw adults under the bus.
Right.
Because I think this is a big thing learned in PC caps.
I'm going to talk about last semester because I think this sums up the whole real world experience. I was on a project that was supposed to be with the city working on how to make the golf course more carbon neutral because, as you've heard, the city's supposed to go carbon neutral by 2022 and then the whole city itself by 2032.
Right.
That fell through because they didn't want to give us the information with fertilizers and all that because it's apparently not good. So we end up on a
proprietary. It's not good. It's proprietary.
Okay. Right. Now we ended up
So that project then kind of just dies on the vine.
That died. So then we end up with another project on the city that was for the new utilities building. Then I think that one fell through, or we just decided to change projects to work on the project that we ended up working on, which was figuring out the last mile, which is how to get from your destination off the bus to your end location, which might be your house, place on Main Street, or et cetera. But then halfway through that project, that scope completely changes to now we're trying to figure out how to incentivize this high school age group to get back on the bus, since once you hit the age of 16, who cares about the bus? It's all about the car.
Right.
And so we now had to spend the last month of our project figuring out how to incentivize this high school age group, and pretty much connecting with them took about a month, because I think we scheduled 3 final meetings within this one project. So just being willing to change and all that, and just adapting to that.
Flexibility.
Wow.
Adaptability.
You've really worked on a lot of projects this year, it sounds like. How many different projects?
I've worked on three this year. Yeah. So I worked on one first semester, and then I've worked on two this semester.
Okay. So a couple minutes left. Where do you go from here? You guys are graduating. Are you interested in pursuing engineering in college?
Yeah, we're both actually going for engineering. I'm going to CU Boulder, and I am majoring in aerospace engineering, and I got offered to do a minor in biomedical.
And I'm going to a Division III school in Grand Rapids, Michigan called Calvin College, where I'm going to study mechanical engineering.
Good.
All right.
Good.
So how much did, I mean, I know a lot of kids who are into math and science, they go towards engineering, but how much did this experience in PC Caps kind of form, confirm, or have you make alterations to your plans?
It honestly changed me, because before high school and before PC Caps, I wanted to go into architecture like Mr. Humbert here. And then now coming into this project, I was like, okay, maybe civil engineering. And then now it's like more mechanical, which is where I'm going to end up going, hopefully.
That's great. How about you, Sky?
Yeah, I guess I've always wanted to go into engineering. It's my sister's doing it. But being in PC Caps has showed me that even though I don't have an engineering major or I don't have a degree, that I can make change in my community and I can work for, like, people can actually respect me as like a partner or a kind of a contractor for a project. So that's pretty cool.
That's great. And Chris Humbert, any last words?
I can just say that this experience with Caps this first year has been great for me. I think it's very authentic, and it's really engaging for the kids, because it's very real, hands-on experience.
Have other schools approached you about?
We've had a number of school districts come through because they want to replicate.
Right.
I think it was Tooele and Duchesne both came through. I know Wasatch High School down in Heber, they just started a CAPS program this year.
Good.
So I met their director earlier last year in Kansas City, where this whole program started. So it's a nationwide network, and we're one of the very first schools that picked it up. And now we're growing again, which is very good.
And we must mention quickly that PC Caps, of course, doesn't just exist with the engineering program. You have software design.
Digital media.
That's right. That's good.
And business and entrepreneurship.
Business. Mm-hmm.
So we have four different strands.
All right. Well, great program. Sky Martin, Josh Lansky, and Chris Humbert, thanks for joining us. And we'll be excited to hear, Chris, about what you're doing next year. Well, next school year, we'll get you on in the beginning of the year when you're kind of putting things together.
That's a deal.
All right. It's Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
I want to thank our underwriters today, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Peak Art and Frame, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services Utah Property, Park City Mountain, and San Francisco Design.
Real quick, you have to mention that talk next Wednesday. You guys did a fantastic interview yesterday on the mountain life.
We were speaking with Kevin Hines yesterday. He, regrettably, I mean, it's an incredibly poignant story. He flung himself off the Golden Gate Bridge 17 years ago to commit suicide, realized what a horrible mistake he had made right afterwards. Somehow, miraculously, he survived without lasting injury. He speaks around the world now. He's speaking in Park City next Wednesday at the Jim Santee Auditorium at 6:30 p.m. The talk is free. He's talking about mental health awareness and how to get help when you need it, because it's something he didn't do.
And and Tim did a great interview with him. Listen to that interview.
Yeah, you can find it on kpcw.org under The Mountain Life. And it's KPCW Park City. It's time now for NPR News. Thanks for listening.